Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Wow, this is exciting. I have looked for years to have a proper study of Ecclesiastes, Kohelet in the Hebrew Bible. I wanted to study it deeply myself. I wanted to be studying it with the right people. And wow, it's a dream come true.
All come together.
I found when I was studying this book, and began to study it more deeply, it just was like something, a book you read, a movie you see, a course you take, where you know from the very beginning, this is meant for me. This is something I not only want to do, but I need to do. In fact, I developed a hypothesis that as you get over 50 or 60 years of age, it is for you. This book is for you. And I think I encourage you, not only in the study we're doing for these 2 weeks, but to go back and read it yourself and to see if it isn't so. Here's a book, essentially. I'll tell you a little bit more about what the scholars say in a moment. But by tradition, here's a book that the wisest man in the world wrote after his life had turned sour, which is interesting in and of itself, an exploration on his part of what the heck happened here. I thought I knew everything. So to have the wisest person in the world writing a book about things that had gone wrong, what meaning does life have, does life have meaning, and then to begin to find what that meaning might be, wow, that's something that Sandy Crest at the age of 70 years old, and I'm sure all the rest of you are thinking that would be something that would be good. I had some conversations with friends in Dallas. I told them I was beginning to prepare a course on this at a Rangers game during the summer. And they told me this sort of poignant story about a fellow who was dying, a friend of theirs, who very bright, incredibly successful materially person, wanted his friends to study this book with him. And he found great meaning in it in his last days. And I can certainly understand why. This is a Kohelet in the Hebrew Bible. By tradition, it was written by Solomon. It was the third and last of the books he wrote. We've studied, in the last 2 weeks, we studied the first, Song of Songs. We spent a lot of time on Proverbs, his second. And now here we are at Kohelet and Ecclesiastes, his third. The first he wrote when he was young and idealistic, and that book is in his name. And then he began to stray a little bit, and so it began to be written in the name of the son of King David. That was how he was able to write these last two books. And then, of course, as we saw, that Song of Songs was at the dedication of the temple, Proverbs in midlife, and then here Ecclesiastes toward the end. Now, scholars say that's just not all true, that it was really written much later. It was written in somewhere between 200 and 450 BCE, you know, after the return to when a lot of these books, scholars say, were written, when there was a return and a building of the Second Temple. We'll leave it be. Maybe they were both true. Maybe it was begun to be written earlier, and then editing and redacting was done. Mike?
Well, one of the reasons they say that is it's full of what are called Persian loan words.
Right.
There's a whole lot of Persian words in there that wouldn't have been in
Solomon's time.
Yeah.
But would have been when the people returned from Babylon. So that's exactly right. Thanks for that, Mike. So I do want to say now, this is really an important part of this introduction, that the views on this book cover a wide spectrum, and they go all the way from and this happens to be, it's always sort of so, I think, traditional Jewish thought and traditional older Christian thought, as pretty much always, are absolutely square with each other. They take the view that this book is intended to be idealistic, positive, about following God, and that all the stuff that seems otherwise is sort of just a challenge. It's meant to say something else. I must confess, and I think Mike and I are going to have some interesting coffees about this, because I think we might disagree a little bit. But I happen to fall on the more idealistic side of the spectrum. And I'm going to use some translation, some literary tools to show you why I think they get the better of the argument. But it goes all the way to the other side, where there is more of a pessimistic, a meaninglessness sort of idea, that life is meaningless, or that that there is little of value, that the traditional ideas are challenged. And you get all the way to that side. One of the things I think that makes this book so powerful is that a good argument can be made all across the spectrum as to what it is. And whichever side of the spectrum you're on, you have to confess that the other side, the other point of view, presents a challenge you have to take seriously. You have to work at it. And there are certain places, and a verse in particular we're going to look at today, that really makes it difficult. And I think biblical, there are some biblical tricks, there are ways of interpreting the Bible that gets you to, of course I've worked hard at it, to get you to the more idealistic or God-oriented, God-fearing side of this. But we'll have some debates in this. It really is a difficult book to study in just 2 weeks, but we're going to do our very best. So the traditionalists say that the summation of it is in 12:13 toward the end, fear God and keep his commandments, for that is man's whole duty. Follow God. And that's what life is meant for us to do. And then as I say, others say, well, either that verse or others at the end were put in by an editor who wanted to make it, I can see Mike nodding at this, who wanted to make it more conventional, to get it in the Bible or to get it in the Bible saying what we want it to say. And that the message is really contrary to that. Or you can view that this is really the theme that runs throughout the entire book. Solomon, it is said, would recite this book to the people on Sukkot, the tabernacles, for a variety of reasons. Philosophical book, that whatever else life has, one has to be struggling with these sorts of issues, and that life without the service of God is empty and meaningless. That's what they say. This means that it's worth keeping that in mind. I want us to get started, Mike, with just verses 1 through 3 in chapter 1.
The words of Kohelet, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Utter futility, said Kohelet. Utter futility. All is futile. What real value is there for a man in all the gains he makes beneath the sun?
Well, the attack of Sandy Crest begins with understanding the butchery. And I think even Mike would agree with me on this. The butchery that the translators do with the Hebrew word that is cited as meaningless or futile, that is not what that word says. And even Mike agrees. Now, you get off on the wrong track when the book begins with life is futile or life is meaningless. Well, it's pretty hard for us idealists to come along and fight that. Well, our first attack begins on the total mistranslation of the word hevel, which means vaporous. It means as if a breath happens and disappears. That's really what it means. Vaporous is a vapor. And then it's gone. Now, does that mean it was meaningless? No. It just means that something happens that happens very quickly, and then it's gone. Not that it's meaningless. This is a very important thing to understand. I had to begin my attack. I didn't even ask my question. How is this thing conventionally understood? I think it's apparent. I mean, if you all want to add to that, please do. When you read this, forgetting what I just said, If you were to read these first three verses, where do you start with?
Very negative.
What's the use?
Nothingness.
Futility. Nothing. It has no value. Once you come to conclude that, then it's kind of hard to come back. In fact, there's so much proof in it, and we'll get to it. There are times in this book where Solomon says, much to the contrary, I find great value in this, this, and this. Even in life, in regular life. So that all is futile, that all is meaningless, is not what he's intending to say. That it happens quickly and passes away, he is trying to say. And this is sort of the second main point, what words in those first three verses are clues as to the meaning of what it is that passes away? This is very important.
The games he makes under the sun?
Under the sun. Well, I didn't realize I was going to be an advocate right from the beginning. Usually I like to teach and draw it out of you, but here the challenge has forced me into a position I don't want to take. What might under the sun mean? What does it mean? Why did he say under the sun?
Daytime.
Or just time. Under God.
Under heaven.
Everything. That's interesting. Everything. I don't think so, but I entertain it. Yes, Char.
I didn't have a problem with this because I saw it as worldly goods. Things that we do for our own gain, stuff that you can't take to heaven. You can't take it with you anyway.
I'm going to recruit you to my debate. You're on my debate team, Char.
I've always worried about people who don't believe in God because this is their life. How do you...
I knew I could count on you, Char. Now, let me ask you this, though. How do you get to that point of view? How do the words under the sun help get to your point of view? Now, because we were having the view up here that under the sun is everything or all things or all that. What would you argue in contrast with that under the sun to mean?
Well, I got there a couple words before that.
Yeah.
What real value is there for a man in all the gains he makes? Not the gains God makes.
Good.
He makes for God.
That he makes.
On earth.
Okay, good. So you get at it. You get at it from the point of view of gains, of things that we do, of things we make.
On our own.
So that gets you to the first. That's the first clue. This is not about everything. What does under the sun add to what you just said?
Yeah, I think I interpret it as during his earthly life.
During his earthly life, but I think we've got to go a little further. During his earthly life, where?
On the earth.
On the earth.
Under God's reign.
Well, I don't know that I agree with that. Under the sun, what is above the sun?
Heaven.
No.
Heaven.
Huh?
Heaven.
Go ahead.
To me, it seems like time.
Well, the time.
Because they used clocks. And time just marches on continuously. The time that we have, or the labor that we do, is under a time that just keeps going that we can't stop.
Well, there's certainly an argument there, but I think you're making the pessimist case. They argue, and that's fine. You might be trying to. I don't know. That because we'll get to some verses here in a moment. That it's as if it's relentless. It's linear. It just happens without meaning. It's just a minute here, a minute there, a minute, and it's very flat. That's what happens. And that's what life is. Life is just this, which would suggest meaningless. It's just futile. It just goes on without interruption. It just passes, which I think would go along with either vaporous or meaningless. But what's another way of looking at under the sun? Not that the sun is the timekeeper, or that sets the under suggests that there's a over. Come on, people. Wake up. I don't have much time with you today. Over the sun. That there are things that happen in this world. And then there are things that happen also in this world, but that are from above the sun. From beyond the sun. from beyond the time, if you will, if you want to use the idea of time. There is something that happens from elsewhere, which paves the way for us to begin to think about this as bifurcated. There are things that happen in the material world under the sun, and there are things that happen that are motivated by, that are instigated by, from what we would say is above the sun. The heavenly world, the godly domain. Not to say that it does come down and affect us in our world. That's why I would be reluctant to say on the earth or in our lives. Because we have things that affect us in our lives from above the sun, as well as under the sun. Okay, so let's go on to look at, in these three verses, I know we're spending a lot of time on these three verses, but there's a promise of the Bible that is in question here. Can you see what that might be? Mike?
Well, I think a lot of the things that I learned out of Proverbs was different than this.
Yeah.
And Proverbs tended to say, if you really do well, you're going to be okay, and if you do badly, you're not going
to
do okay.
Exactly. And that seems to be true in other parts of the Bible, including the five books and elsewhere.
Deuteronomy
in particular. Okay. You live as God expects, things will turn out well for you. You don't, they don't. This seems to be suggesting that it just goes on.
It doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter how it goes. So the promise of the Bible that things will go well for us, maybe even in material ways too. Mm-hmm. Deuteronomy seems to suggest that. Or maybe that's really not what it's saying. Maybe when we went through Deuteronomy, we said that might be more of a notion of some spiritual success that we would have. But that we would have success if we live in God's ways. This is almost saying, or it could be read as saying, no, that's not so. But it raises this issue. And it certainly puts in play the idea, again, that things under the sun may not be governed by the promises of the Bible. That just the fact that we live a material life, it may or may not go well. And that may or may not, be related to how we live with those matters from which we get direction above the sun. Okay, Mike, let's go on and continue in 6 through 10.
Okay. Southward blowing, turning northward, ever turning, blows the wind. On its rounds, the wind returns. All streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place from which they flow, the streams flow back again. All such things are wearisome. No man can ever state them. The eye has never enough of seeing, nor the ear enough of hearing. Only that shall happen which has happened. Only that occur which has occurred. There is nothing new beneath the sun. Sometimes there is a phenomenon of which they say, look, this one is new. It occurred long since in ages that went by before us. The early ones are not remembered, so too are those that will occur later will no more be remembered than those which occur at the very end.
Stay, Mike, because I want to keep reading. We talked this out. Again, this is an idea of time marches on, things kind of just flow. There's no particular meaning in them. Under the sun. He's making a distinction. I want you to begin to think, because I'm going to ask you about it here in a moment after these next verses are read, why, if King Solomon wrote these verses, wrote this book, and he wrote it, I want you to be thinking about the time we studied Solomon together. What happened in his life? What did he do? How might he have become disenchanted? How might he have seen the world in a way in which wisdom, in which plans, the order of things didn't quite play out as he was taught, or at least as he thought in his mind? Why did that happen? Be thinking about that as you listen to these next verses. Mike, let's go on to,
Can I interject one thing I just can't resist.
Yeah.
Several thousand years earlier than it was articulated in the 18th century is a biblical statement of the hydrologic cycle. number, which may mean something to a few people. But the other thing here, this, there was a very long ago, read it wasn't a book, it was just an essay, that had the title, Time Zero, Time Cycle. And the theme of that, which has always stuck with me, is that in Western thought, and in generally in Judeo-Christian thought, we see time as moving forward. But in Eastern thought, and Eastern religion, it's circle. Things repeat. Reincarnation would be one sort of manifestation of that. These verses are very Eastern. It's basically saying it just goes around and around. There is no linear progression,
right,
which is really very non-Judeo-Christian.
And maybe, Mike, would you say maybe a thought that was picked up during the time in Babylon?
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's right. That's right.
And the other one is some of the Greek philosophers, particularly in Greek philosophy, there was a thing called, if I can remember it, what was the guy's name? Anyway, one of the Greek schools, it talks just like this. I mean, exactly like this.
Uh-huh.
And it has the same prescription later, of saying, so what do you do? How do you live if this is the way it is? And it says, you try to live a simple life and have a few friends, eat well, and take good care of yourself, and because time is short.
We'll get to that, but it's that plus. We're already into our deal here. Okay, we'll get to those verses. But, Mike, let's go ahead and read now 12 through 18 of 1, and then these first few verses in chapter 2.
Okay. All such things are wearisome. No man can ever state them. The eye never has enough of seeing, nor the ear enough of hearing. Only that shall happen which has happened. Only that which has occurred. There is nothing new beneath the sun. Sometimes there is a phenomenon of which they say, look, this one is new. It occurred long since in ages that went before us. The earlier ones are not remembered. So, too, those that will occur later will no more be remembered than those that will occur at the very end. Achilles was king in Jerusalem over Israel. I set my mind to study and to probe with wisdom all that happens under the sun. An unhappy business, that which God gave men to be concerned with. I observed all the happenings beneath the sun, and I found that all is futile in pursuit of wind. A twisted thing cannot be made straight, a lack that cannot be made good. And I said to myself, here I've grown richer and wiser than any that ruled before me over Jerusalem, and my mind has zealously absorbed wisdom and learning. And so I set my mind to appraise wisdom and to appraise madness and folly, and I learned that this too was pursuit of wind. For as wisdom grows, vexation grows. To increase learning is to increase heartache.
Now, so whichever side of the spectrum you're on, it's very instructive to remember what happened in Solomon's life. What happened during Solomon's reign? Does anyone want to try to give us a summary of what we learn about him, whether it's in Kings or in any repetition of it in Chronicles or anywhere else? Does anybody remember what happened in Solomon's reign?
He had too many wives.
And he married women of other faiths, other countries.
Good.
So they brought in their thought and their behavior.
Right. Good.
And amassed
huge wealth. Remember the rule, the mitzvot? We studied under the 613. You should have neither too many wives, too many horses, or too much wealth.
Over three
on this guy. And that, I mean, so is it possible that he would be deemed by God as over three in this respect? And the people were punished. And after Solomon, there's a separation from Israel and Judah. The kingdom splits. Which the religious notions in the book say occurred because of his being over three. Now, what else? What else happened in his reign? Any other recollections of the story or the events?
The temple was built.
The temple was built at the beginning. Absolutely. Any other thoughts? Huh? Yeah.
His judgments that he did.
Well, his judgments, and we remember from the early part of it, his judgments were Torah true, and they seem to be wise. And remember, we associate wisdom with him. He pursued wisdom. And I guess my question to you would be, how do you square his pursuit of wisdom with how he lived his life in these rather unhappy and unfortunate ways that we discussed? What must have caused, have you have any thoughts about what caused him to do those things?
He didn't follow his own advice.
Well, he didn't follow his own advice, but his own advice suggests, well, go back to your thinking about Proverbs. How could you view Proverbs in a way that would lead you to live as Solomon lived? And how can you view Proverbs in a way that brings you to a new view after you've made those mistakes? What must you be thinking about wisdom that would cause you to make the decisions he made that led him astray? What? This is kind of cool. I've never had this conversation, but it's a fun one to have. What must his view of wisdom have been? Because he's talking about, I sought wisdom. I pursued wisdom. And I found under the sun it was all futile. It was all terrible. He did. But what was his view of wisdom that he's now looking back on and saying, there was something really wrong with that?
He thought it was all of him and it wasn't given from God.
Well, I think he may have, I mean, remember in Proverbs. In Proverbs, you recall, it starts with wisdom and discipline and knowledge and understanding. And then it comes around to say, fear of God is the start of it all, is the foundation of it all. Is it possible the two got disconnected?
He got away from that as his life was.
Did he get away from that? Now, how do people who are wise get away from that? I think you were on to it.
They do it all the time.
People do it all the time. And how do they do it?
They get oversaturated with the worldly things, wealth and wives and children and horses and castles.
Exactly. And the thought is that the wisdom, I'm wise, which teaches me how to do that. Yeah. Wisdom is how to live in the world. Not hard to get there. If I marry this woman, she's beautiful. B, I can extend the power of the kingdom and these ways to that world. The mind is working, right?
And I won't have an adversary.
This is wisdom. But it's wisdom that is gradually being disconnected
from
fear of God. You see? It's the whole is being separated into the two. I think we're going to find, as in what we're about to read, that he begins to understand that. Camille.
It seems like wisdom without experience is hubris, you know. And so he had all this wisdom as a young man. He was following both his own smarts and a God-driven life. But without experience, that knocks you down over time. That's why people over 50 like this book.
Well, yeah. But the experience, it comes in two phases. The first part is the experience of living out the wisdom the way you think you should in the world. So there's hubris in having the wisdom before you experience things. And then there is the living out and the hope that the wisdom will play out to your advantage. And then you start thinking, I have a lot of wives. I have a lot of wealth, i.e. I'm successful. And I got it because I'm smart. I told that, what was the woman's name that he marries? I mean, Bathsheba's his mother. Who's the most beautiful woman in the world he marries? No.
Well, it was Bathsheba.
No. She comes, there's beautiful stories. She sees, this is terrible, the tape's going to show, Mike, you'll have to finish. This is Mike Irvin, what Sandy meant to remember was. The Queen of Sheba, yeah. And she comes and she looks at the way he would have really pleased my wife if she had come. The design of the temple, all the palace is beautiful, everything is put together right. She's impressed, and they, of course, get married. All of this is wisdom. All of this is wisdom of the worldly wise. Worldly wise. And then all of a sudden, and he's got horses, and he's got power, and all of a sudden, in the world above the sun, it ain't going so well. It ain't going so well. That's what he's beginning to understand now. older, after he's had these experiences, he's beginning to look back on his life and saying, I thought that was wisdom. It felt like it was wisdom. It's what I learned. I was a wise man. And yet, I've gotten to a place now, older in years and in life, and now I'm not sure. So let's see. And now, Mike, let's go to the 13, the 17, the 20, the 21, and 26. Now he begins to talk to you about wisdom, about what he thinks now.
I found that wisdom is superior to folly, as light is superior to darkness.
Hold on a second. Whoa, I thought everything was meaningless. All of a sudden now, he says, I confess, I learned that wisdom is superior to folly.
That's Proverbs.
But, go on.
A wise man has his eyes in his head, whereas a fool walks in darkness. But I also realize the same fate awaits them both. So I reflected, the fate of...
Wait a minute, so what is that fate, by the way?
Death.
Yes. So the wise person dies, and the foolish person dies. This is going to be a theme throughout all of Ecclesiastes. And as you get older, we begin to confront death. And it is a great leveler. It is a great leveler. And so now he's saying, okay, even though I saw a difference, they both die. Go ahead, Mike.
Okay. So I reflected, the fate of the fool is also destined for me. To what advantage, then, have I been wise? And I came to the conclusion that too was futile. Because the wise man, just like a fool, is not remembered forever. For as the succeeding days roll by, both are forgotten. Alas, the wise man dies just like the fool. And so I loathed life, for I was distressed by all that goes on under the sun, because everything is futile and a pursuit of wind.
This under the sun phrase, by the way, are you noticing how many times it's mentioned? And always keep in mind what we talked about it might mean. Go ahead, Mike.
And so I came to view with despair all the gains I had made under the sun.
All the gains I made under the sun. So, again, Mike, I'm sorry to interrupt you. What are those gains, all those gains he made under the sun?
His wealth,
his wives, everything that he used his smarts to get.
Sometimes I say it's not just material, it's what you, I mean, I was a really smart mom when I was younger.
Yeah.
I knew how to rear children.
And then now you see some despair in your hubris.
But I'm just saying you have a sense of humility and modesty later about how smart, how wise you were.
Right. Okay, Mike, go on.
For sometimes a person whose fortune was made with wisdom, knowledge, and skill must hand it off a portion to somebody who did not toil for it.
Well, wait a minute. Okay, go ahead. This is not... Go ahead and read that. The rest of the verse, I'm sorry.
That too is futile and a grave evil.
So what is that recognition? One thing I love about this is wherever you are on the spectrum, these realities, this understanding at a certain stage of your life, the realities that... One can't argue with. We die. All of us die. The wise person and the fool dies. What's the second recognition?
Sometimes things aren't fair. Just
things happen. That's true, too. But in 21, what's the second recognition?
You can't take it with you.
And how ironic it is, all the wisdom that you brought to bear in gaining it, now the darn stuff is going to end up in the hands of a fool. Or it could, or it might not. There's no order to it. This is definitely futility. It's futility. It's vaporous, and it's either one, I think. It's certainly vaporous. There's nothing sustaining about the idea that I made all. There's no reason to it. If I can make it, and I can't keep it, and it could go to a fool, then under the sun, what must I conclude about all of these gains I made? Exactly. We come to all of these words. Because all of it was vaporous. It really, I got it, and then it and I disappear. Right, Char?
I think it's even worse than that.
I tried to make it. My debate partner.
Don't go make their own wealth. Have no self-esteem. We've just seen children of wealth destroy their lives. I mean, it's really sad. We see it all the time. I don't know how you teach children. Very few people have figured out how to hand off wealth to children who have their own self-esteem and their own self-value and can handle it. So
well,
and it's even worse than that.
Right.
Destroy my children with this wealth.
Well, or Solomon may be just saying, even worse than that is there's no rhyme or reason to any of it.
Right.
You can't. I mean, there. Not only is it difficult, it's going to end up in the hands of people who will, you know,
squander.
Thank you. That's a better word than the one that was coming to my mind. You probably know what that word. We can't say that word. You can't say that word in church. So we come now. There are two verses that are part of my arsenal in my debate with my good friend here. One of them is 2:26.
To the man, namely, who pleases him.
Him would be
God.
Capital H.
Yeah. He has given the wisdom and shrewdness to enjoy himself. And to him who displeases him, he has given the urge to gather and amass, only for handing on to someone who is pleasing to God. That, too, though, is futile in pursuit of wind.
So, this is a key line for people who believe that this verse is key to people who think this book has meaning. And there is something, it begins to define what's above the sun. Do you see what it is here in 26? There is something that is futile. But there's also a distinction that's being made in this verse that suggests a little bit about what we see, what we learn, what obtains above the sun. What is it? There are two ideas here.
One who's pleasing to God.
Who is one who is pleasing to God?
A believer.
A believer. One who finds wisdom from God. One who goes back. The student, late in life, the Solomon, the us, who go back in life and say, you know, I forgot that verse in Proverbs. It all begins with the fear of God. That, I think he's beginning to see here, that is a certain kind of wisdom. That is what wisdom means biblically to religious people, to people who please God. That is wisdom. It's not the wisdom to go out in the world and make a lot of money and get married to it and get a lot of power. It is the wisdom that makes one pleasing to God. Remember, it says to a man, namely to a person who pleases God, whom he has given the wisdom and the shrewdness. Remember, those were words in Proverbs. And then he begins to talk about what one does with wealth. We're going to get that in a minute. To enjoy himself. In other words, to live life, not for the amassing of great wealth and power, but to live it fully. That's one of the first lessons. It's not futile. There's no futility or meaninglessness in living life meaningfully or joyfully for what it is. That is something that has meaning. But to those who are thinking that it's all in the gathering and the amassing, that is not pleasing to God, and that's not what life has, and whatever wisdom brings us there is not real wisdom, is not true wisdom, and there is folly in that part of life. So, Mike, I've kept you up here. We've talked about 26, but I want us now to begin to go. It's really important that we get to these verses in 3.
Man through 22.
So let me just say, before we get to 9 through 22, I'm sure you all, those of you who lived in the 60s and enjoyed rock music and so forth and so on, you recognize verses 1 through 8, right? Huh?
Turn.
The birds, right? This is the source of that music, and we can spend time talking on it. We begin to see in 3, 1 through 8, we begin to see that there is a rhyme or reason to the way things happen in the world. But I want us to go on to 3 through 9, through 22. And I may interrupt you, Mike, but I want you, we're going to get to 21 and 22 are such crucial verses They're the second set of verses that I really want to make sure you pay attention to. But let's begin our march of 3, 9 through 22.
What value, then, can the man of affairs get from what he earns? I have observed the business that God gave man to be concerned with. He brings everything to pass precisely at its time. He also puts eternity in their mind, but without man ever guessing from first to last all the things that God brings to pass.
Now, again, I want you to pay attention to these words and to it's a scaffolding. He's building his way to an idea. This idea, I love this. So things happen in their own time. We learn that in 1 through 8. He also puts eternity in their mind. He puts above the sun in their mind. This is a key recognition that Solomon's making in this verse. Go ahead, Mike.
Thus I realize that the only worthwhile thing there is for them is to enjoy themselves and do what is good in their lifetime. Also, that whenever a man does eat and drink and get enjoyment out of all of his wealth, it is a gift of God.
Let me stop for a second. And so this is important. You could say that one learns from this that one should eat, drink, and be merry. But I would say that Solomon's beginning here, not ending with that, he's beginning to teach us that there are things in life, in the life we live, in our lives, that are not futile, that are not meaningless, and in some way are not vaporous. And he's saying here to start with that enjoying life for what it is not just an attitude one has after one's become hopeless about anything more. It's at the heart of what we're here to do, of what life should be. Partly because it's not futile, it's meaningful. In other words, even, I think he would argue, there's a moment of eternity in living a life that has joy. And as we learned in the Hasidic tales, those moments of joy, of living life richly, just the simple life we have, that is a God-given reality that has eternity in it. Okay, go ahead, Mike.
I realize, too, that whatever God has brought to pass will recur evermore. Nothing can be added to it, nothing can be taken from it, and God has brought to pass that men revere him. What is occurring occurred long since, and what is to occur occurred long since, and God seeks the pursued. And indeed, I have observed under the sun, alongside justice there is wickedness. Alongside righteousness there is wickedness.
Let's stop for a moment on that. Under the sun. I've observed under the sun in this material world, in this world in which we are operating largely on our own, that wickedness accompanies justice and wickedness accompanies righteousness. Why would that be?
Because you're talking about human beings.
Mm-hmm. Human beings living under the sun.
Right.
Under the principles that are operative without regard to above the sun.
With free will.
With free will. And they will choose often to go wicked.
Yep.
And he sees that they're both there. Okay, he sees that and understands that just operating under the sun, this is the way the world will be. Go ahead, Mike.
And so I muse. God will doom both righteous and wickedness. And wicked, for there is a time for every experience and for every happening.
Got to stop you there. This is JPS, huh?
Yes.
I'm going to take them in the back room and put a whipping on their behind, as I used to tell my children. That word is not doom. Really? I want the guy here. I want to just, I shouldn't. This is what's on the rock. I'm engaging in this. I'm attacking this person. I shouldn't do that. Let me just go after the idea. The word is not, let me find it here.
By the way, I should tell the class, JPS is the Jewish publication.
Yeah. And how they came to doom is beyond me. It's not doom, and I think any other translation I've seen, Jewish or Christian, the word is shafat, which is related, those of you who know this, is related to mishpat. And what is mishpat? You remember mishpat from our... It's judgment. Justice or judgment is mishpat. So So the phrase ought to be, and how wrong we get it, instead of God will doom both righteous and wicked, God will judge both righteous and wicked. For there is a time for every experience and for every happening. So, as one will see in all, would see in all the great classic Christian commentaries, or in the Chabad, the other Jewish commentaries, this is really important. So there's wickedness and righteousness in the world under the sun, and religious people believe that God will judge people who are righteous, those people who are wicked, and their consequences. This is what Solomon is saying. This comes from above the sun. It's not doom, both of them. Golly. Anyway, I just wanted to make sure you had that.
Well, in reality, we are doomed to judgment.
We're doomed to judgment, but since the judgment goes different directions, depending on what is found and what God does, assuming we don't repent, that's really what... This is a part of the idea that Solomon comes to a recognition that God is in the world, that what comes from above the sun matters, and that in whatever is going on in this world under the sun, that God is there and will provide for ultimate judging and justice. Okay, Mike, let's go on. Yeah.
I just have to soften you up a little bit. And say, I think that, you know, the turn in the song,
yeah,
that's a beautiful line, because that really in Hebrew is to turn is teshuvah.
Yeah.
So it's not a blunt action, like repent. It means repent is teshuvah.
Yeah.
So it's not repent. It's a constant turning in life. Turning.
Right.
So that judgment takes place, but it takes place in a life that is constantly, if you are constantly God facing Godward and turning, it's a welcoming kind of thing.
I didn't mean to be harsh about that. And actually, I was just trying in the spirit of your ancestors to do old-fashioned Baptist preaching. I didn't mean to go too far. You're seeing a little family drama play out for you here.
Lawrence? If we were all doomed, then that would give credence to the life they made.
Thank you. Thank you. Lawrence said we're going to have you advise and work with our family. Okay. Okay, go ahead, Mark.
So I decided, as regards men, to dissociate them from the divine beings and to face the fact that they are beasts.
I don't know about that either.
Yeah.
I didn't mark that down. Okay, I will look it up now. Just put a footnote on that one. Okay. What he's really saying is, there are divine beings, there are human beings, and there are beasts. This distinction is being made, and he's going to talk about it more as we get into 19.
For in respect of the fate of man and the fate of beast, they have one and the same fate. As one dies, so dies the other. Both have the same life breath. Man has no superiority over beasts, since both amount to nothing.
Now let's talk for a second. One could go in the direction of thinking there's no difference between people and beasts. If one reads this, he's saying in one important respect, there's no difference between human beings and beasts. What is that respect in which they're similar?
They both die.
Their life under the sun on the earth ends, whether you're a human being or you're a beast. This is really what he's saying here. And this is really important to get the distinction, because he's about to say something in verse 21 that I want to spend the rest of our time with, 21 and 22 when we get there. That's what he's saying. He's not saying in all respects, which this translation... Now, again, I want to argue with myself here a little bit. One of the beautiful things about this book is that it's written to where you can kind of, you have to really grasp all possibilities with these verses. It's written this way for a reason. It's written for you to ask, is there any difference between us? And we wonder sometimes. But I think what he's really saying here is, for sure, we share in one thing. In our physical being, in our material being, in life, that ends for both. Okay, Mike, go ahead.
Who knows if a man's life breath does rise upward and if a beast's breath does sink down into the earth?
Okay. This is where I want to stop for a while, Mike. You can
take a rest, Mike.
Now, this verse is packed. Let's get back through it. The translation is pretty good. Who knows if a man's life breath does rise upward? Life breath, remember, is spirit. It's ruach. It can be breath or it can be spirit. So we can think about it either way. Who knows if a man's spirit does rise upward and if a beast's spirit or breath does sink down into the earth? So it's posed as a question. It's a crucial question. Whether it's a question or a statement, we're going to get to in a minute. And what the answer to the question is important. And we'll get to some possibilities. What is the significance of this verse?
Resurrection.
It could be. But it's not necessarily that.
It seems like...
Let me just deal with that. It's just whether resurrection, it could be resurrection, or it could be upon death, does our spirit go to God, as opposed to what we think may be the case with a beast? Does our spirit go to God or not? Go ahead.
Well, that's what I was
saying. Okay. Yes, sure.
Only God knows the answer.
Okay. That one, when we ask the question, we have to answer the question. And one possibility is it pushes us into a position of humility. I don't know for sure. God knows. That's one possibility. That we're wrestling with it. Why are we wrestling with this? This is huge. Why are we wrestling? Why does Solomon want us to wrestle with it in the first place?
I think it's part of the human struggle, the human condition.
It is.
Wondering.
Wondering. But why are we wondering? We've been talking. What have we been saying here? What did we say in the verse before? We said in the verse before there didn't appear to be any difference between the beast and us. We said even earlier than that there didn't seem to be any difference between the righteous and the unrighteous. We said before that it's not clear that there's anything meaningful in our lives. This is designed to say, well, but wait a minute. If we answer this question, our spirit does go to God. Isn't that a significant answer to all of these issues? Then there is meaning. From above the sun, perhaps, there is meaning to our life. There is a difference between acting kindly, lovingly, righteously, and being wicked. There's a big difference. There is a difference. If the answer to this is it happens, there's a big difference between us and the beast. Not in the way we die, that's all the same. There's a big difference. So we're asking this question as if to say, is it true or not? And then who knows? The who knows, that there may be a literary thing with the who knows, which I'm going to tell you about in a minute. Do you see all that? Mm-hmm. Now, let me tell you, this is where Solomon has a whole series of verses in mind because he wrote some of them. And it's important to know that because he knows. He thinks he knows. And we also find that other authors in the Bible purport to know. Let's look at some of them. In Proverbs 15:24, who purportedly was the author of Proverbs?
Solomon.
The guy who's asking, who knows? So if he were brought in to be tested on this, he would admit, I think I know. He wrote in 15:24, the path of life leads upward for the prudent, that he may turn away from below. Solomon wrote in Proverbs. This happens to the human being. In Ecclesiastes 12 through 7, who wrote Ecclesiastes? Oh, yeah, that's the guy who's writing what we just studied. Dust returns to the earth, and spirit will return to the God who gave it. Just the issue we're talking about. Now, Mike, I guess somebody could argue that somebody put that verse in there, you know, the other side of the debate. I don't know that we even disagree that much. We're just having fun there. But do you understand Solomon says, I think there's an answer. I think I know. People of faith think they know. Do we know for sure? Sure, no. God knows. But people of faith have faith that my spirit goes to God. Which means, huh?
Isn't that the point? What is our wisdom? Is our wisdom to serve God? Is our wisdom to get rich and get a bunch of stuff that doesn't matter?
Exactly. And for people who believe it's to serve God, they think that's their fundamental faith. That, and therefore, there's meaning in above, from that which comes above the sun. Now, this is interesting. In Joel 2:14, 13 and 14, there's a return. This goes to turning, to teshuva. Return to God in teshuva, which is repentance or turning. 2:14, who knows? The words who knows are there in the Bible. He might relent. Who knows is, in other words, a literary form. It's a literary device. It just simply says to the person of faith, it's a way of saying, who knows? It may happen. I have faith that who knows means it could happen. I have faith it will happen. And that's probably what Solomon's drawing upon, that literary convention, to say that God's there. God will accept the Spirit. God will accept the Spirit that comes his way from our lot, from us when we die. So I just want to sort of close in thinking that, in saying that this text is really difficult. There's a lot of humility in it. I think it's not written from the point of view of a person who feels certainty as much in his life as he did. I think the humility that is now on Solomon has come, I think as Camille suggested, from being broken down in some ways. But aren't we all, particularly as we age, as we get to the latter years of life, aren't we broken down, at least in terms of the certainties of youth? Haven't we experienced enough to understand that all those ambitions, all that certainty that we felt earlier, that we were on the right path, that we knew everything, we were wise, we knew best, we learned that all of that is not really true. So we begin to question. We begin to have doubts. We wonder whether life has meaning, and he does here. But I think it's a hard-won victory for Solomon to come back and say that when I was writing Proverbs, I think I got it all, but I think I went off into life with only part of it. And now I understand that wisdom is really in serving God. It wasn't in conquering the world. And now I see that what distinguishes me, what is available to me, is that in serving God, I have a relationship with God. And in that relationship, I have something that goes above the sun, that gives me some certainty. And I can find it there. I couldn't find it on earth. I find it there. And it's a meaning that we will begin to explore more and more in the remaining chapters of this book. It has begun with one idea simply, which is how to live the life God gave me and get joy in its simplicity. I know that. That's a part of something that is eternal. I know, too, that God has infused me with spirit that will live on. Now we'll explore in the rest of the book. So you have to come back next week. We'll explore in the rest of the book those other things that appear to have some element of certainty to them rather than futility. Now you have to come back. Have a good week, everybody.
Thank you.